coming up on the My Ag Life Daily News Report. We are keeping an eye on AB1, which would make some changes to environmental and toxic waste law in the state. And we have today's news brief, but we start today with a check on the almond industry. Joining me on the phone is Malvinder Cahal, almond grower and owner of Atlas Almonds.
All right, Malvinder, so I wanted to just check in with you and see how things are going for you so far this spring. How is the crop looking for you?
The crop is looking surprisingly heavy in general. I think there's a lot of talk going on that, you know, we had a heavy crop last year, and there's a lot of talk going on whether or not we could have a repeat. And I don't think we're going to have a repeat of last year's crop, but I don't think that the drop in production is as steep as, you know, even I was predicting. I really wasn't sure that, an almond orchard would be able to produce, like, such a massive crop consecutive years in a row. But that being said, I'm not seeing that consistently even in my own ranches. It's just mostly the younger trees that have the energy to reproduce that production a second year. Whereas a lot of my older trees, there's a noticeable drop in crop. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, there's a middle ground of expectation of what we're looking at in terms of crop size.
So you're seeing kind of some differences between your newer trees and your old trees. New trees are looking like they're producing really well, and old trees kind of as expected?
Yeah, exactly. You know, last year it looked like anything I did made me look like an amazing farmer. Every ranch was just producing. But this year, there's differences. I can see which ranches are going to have a high level of crop and which ranches are not. So the ranches, you know, that are younger, it seems like they're going to be able to produce what they did last year. But some of my older trees, they're looking like they're going to drop back to what would be a standard level of production, you know, maybe have a 10 to 15% drop in production from last year.
All right. And you're out in Madera County. Mm-hmm. And so how is water going to affect you this year? What are you looking at for that drought?
Well, you know, from what I'm hearing is the availability of surface water from the irrigation district will be very limited. And so we farm in Merced and Stanislaus County as well, and we're in the same thing. It's just not going to be a full, you know, summer of water. And in terms of operation, until Sigma comes into place and we're really having to figure out exactly how much water we need to use, I don't think there's going to be a huge logistical aspect. The big thing is, you know, there's always the fear on drought years that your well might fail, right? A motor goes out, something in the well lining collapse. That's the big issue, is just security. When you have canal water, you know, you have something to rely on. You don't have to use your wells as much, so it's not as a big deal. But on years where you know you're not going to get a lot of canal water, and if your well goes out, you know, what's that phrase? You're in the creek without a paddle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that's the main thing. Like, in terms of logistics, it doesn't really affect much. And until we come to a point where Sigma and those other factors come into play, where we actually have to reduce our water usage based on allocation, then it's not going to be an issue. But that's the main thing. The drought year is just going to be interesting to see how it's going to move along legislation and how it's going to move along planning for Sigma, including, you know, the pilot programs for the water market.
And as we talk about Sigma, what kind of things are you doing to prepare, or what are you learning about that, and how ready do you feel for things to go into effect?
It's everyone's doing their homework, or everyone should be, right? So the tricky part is trying to truly understand when everything's going to be implemented. But from my understanding, they're going to take it, you know, 1 year at a time in introducing allocations. And so we're looking at our ranches. The big thing is we're looking at areas where we don't have traditionally a lot of canal water, or ranches where we're in white zones. So we're planting very carefully. And what I mean by that is we're really looking at, hey, can we, you know, push come to shove, we can only use half our water, or are we going to be able to survive? So we're looking at some spots. We're looking at, hey, should we just only plant half? Should we lease it out? Should we look at other crops? So all these conversations are happening, in addition to making shifts into different technologies, right? We're looking at different irrigation methods. We're looking at different water technologies and what makes sense, because you can put a lot of money into monitoring your water, but it doesn't always equal into results. So a lot of homework going on.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we started the interview, we were just kind of chatting about weather a little bit, but how's the weather treating the crop this year so far in spring?
Well, the bees have no excuses not to say they got everything pollinated. The weather was absolutely prime for pollination, right? As that's a side effect. We're in a drought year, poor rain amount. So that being said, when there's usually poor rain amount, the bees have a lot more activity. And we didn't have any real frost events. You know, this year I wasn't up at 2 in the morning turning on wells in preparation for a frost event. Right. So those are usually the two big factors are how cold it gets and how much rain we get. So the bees had all the opportunity to really pollinate. So it's just a matter of whether your orchard has the capability of maximizing that pollination, right? A bee can pollinate every bud on an almond tree. It doesn't mean you're going to get a 5,000-pound crop. It's just, you know, it's about your nutrition. It's about what your soil has. Some factors are just beyond your control. It's about what you treated last year and how much it has in the reserve. But the weather's been good in that sense, but obviously poor in the sense that we're not getting our water replenished.
Right. So aside from water and pollination, as we head into, you know, mid-April, head further into the spring, what's on your mind right now as an almond grower?
Nutrition, right? Nutrition's the big thing. Nutrition and pest management. So with that, you know, we're thinking about, hey, how much – we have our standard nutrition program, and every year we try to do better, and same with our pest programs. But the big thing now becomes – how much do I spend, right? And this is where you got to put your business owner hat on. You got to think, what do I think my crop's going to be? How much do I need to put in? And it's sort of a gamble, because there's also the pest aspect. Do I put X amount of dollar to control for this pest when its damage only cost me Y amount in dollars? So there's a lot of that going on the next, I would say, 3 months, because you also got to decide what you're going to do for your whole split sprays, which generally you make that decision in June before you spray in July.
Mm-hmm. And there is a good, I mean, there is a balance there. You're right, when you're considering how much money you're going to put into it versus how much money does this pest actually cost my crop. Do you see that that's the type of balance that you're often having to consider as you go along?
Oh, yeah. Every year, you know, new technologies and new chemicals are being introduced in terms of pest management. And you got to just really think to yourself, is this worth trying? Do I want to be the one to try it? Do I want to wait? Is it worth maybe just doing a portion of my block where I have problems? So it's just a constant back and forth. You know, there's always something new coming out. There's always something that warrants trying. But at the end of the day, you can just look at it and be like, well, you know, if I already have low damage, I know the industry talks about it a lot, but why am I going to put another $50 per acre if the damage is only costing me $40? Or the damage is costing me only $60, but I don't even know if that $50 might work or not.
Yeah, a lot of things to consider. And I'm sure to talk with, I don't know, would you talk with your PCAs or other experts about that too as you're making those decisions?
Absolutely. You know, I'm talking to my PCA just about every other day about something. And, you know, as farmers, you got to definitely, it's easy for a farmer to feel like they need to be completely independent. At the end of the day, we have a really healthy industry in terms of people who are experts in specific areas and, you know, who to lean on. So I know without a doubt, if I call my PCA, he's going to have answers for me, or he's going to have some sort of, you know, advice. And he'll always tell me, hey, take it with a grain of salt, because he's seen everyone do it 100 different ways. But at the end of the day, you should confer with somebody. You need to spitball ideas. You need to brainstorm.
Is there anything else that really stands out to you this year so far with your almond crop?
I would just say, you know, my dad's really been hammering this in, and I'm big on it too, and I want to relay it out, is when it comes to nutrition, it's easy when we're having poor years to be like, hey, let's cut back on this many units, or let's cut back on, you know, this micronutrients. But that being said, it's hard to recover following years. You know, if you do poor nutrition 1 year, it'll cascade to years to follow. And so that being said, I think it's important to farmers, you know, if they can, try to hold the nutrition program to where it's at. If it feels like excess, yeah, go ahead and trim the fat. But it's important to maintain nutrition, even if the prices aren't there, because we keep these orchards for 20-plus years. And taking away the nutrition in 1 year will affect the following year. So that is, I think, a little piece of advice I'd get out is, you know, don't be scared to spend the money on nutrition. If you need to cut back on other aspects, cut back, but always keep a good amount of nutrition and water for your trees.
Thank you again to Malvinder Kahal of Atlas Almonds. Our news brief is coming up next. We'll be right back.
Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board.
Here's your news brief for today. From the California Farm Bureau, pistachio production and processing pumps more than $5 billion into the California economy, that according to a new study. The group American Pistachio Growers commissioned the report. It says the pistachio business generates more than 47,000 full-time equivalent jobs, with almost $2.5 billion in labor income. The report says farmer investment in new pistachio acreage has helped boost the economic impact. The U.S. International Trade Commission hosted an all-day virtual hearing last week on its investigation into unfair trade practices by foreign exporters on cucumber and squash imports. The ITC expects to send the results of its investigation to the U.S. Trade Representative's office no later than December 7th of this year. Florida Ag Commissioner Nikki Fried testified at the hearing and talked about the injury to Florida's $90.9 million cucumber and $35.4 million squash industries caused by imports. Since 2015, Fried says a surge in imports of fresh and chilled cucumbers and squash, predominantly from Mexico, has caused an estimated loss of 2,721 jobs, lost cash receipts worth $944 million, and $1.85 billion in a negative impact on Florida's domestic produce growers. USDA's latest crop production report shows how weather has had a negative impact on the nation's citrus crop. Stephanie Ho reports.
April is usually a fairly quiet month for USDA's crop production report.
But I think there were some bits and pieces of quite interesting information.
That was Chief Economist Seth Meyer, who pointed to the nation's citrus production.
We see some of the initial implications of that short but intense freeze we had a few weeks back on some of the Texas citrus production numbers.
The Texas all-orange forecast is down 30% from the previous forecast, while in Florida, the forecast is down 7%.
We had a really large increase in the drop. There's this loss of production that comes from dropped fruit. And we saw that have an effect. And that, I think, was a Florida effect. And that tends to be a lagging effect from drought.
The nation's overall all-orange forecast for the 2021 season is 4.45 million tons, down 4% from the March forecast and down 15% from the revised 1920 final utilization. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Biden administration submitted the president's budget priorities for discretionary spending during fiscal year 2022. The funding request advances key USDA priorities like economic development and growth in rural America, supporting American agriculture, aiding in the approach to mitigating climate change, and supporting a strong safety net to address hunger and food insecurity. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack says the president's budget provides the resources to build back better, stronger, and more resilient and equitably than ever before. The request asks for almost $1.7 billion for high-priority hazardous fuels and forest resilience projects to combat the growing threat of wildfires. The president's discretionary request provides an increase of $65 million over the 2021 enacted level for the Rural E-Connectivity Program, ReConnect, which provides grants and loans to deploy broadband in underserved areas. Biden's request also provides $4 billion above the 2021 enacted level for USDA's research, education, and outreach programs. Two segments of agriculture offer examples of technological advances that promise benefits for producers. Here's Rod Bain.
Agricultural innovations are important in the advancement of the specialty crop and niche agriculture sectors. Jim Baer of the U.S. Apple Association says one still under development for his industry, but available for producers of other fruit and nut varieties, is mechanical harvesters.
So long as the technology can be fine-tuned to identify an apple on the tree and reach out and pick that apple and do it in a way that doesn't damage it, that's going to be a huge, huge positive impact.
Mike Newland of the Propane Education and Research Council says innovations in technology used by organic growers include
weed flaming technologies, organic markets, pesticides are things I don't like to use. So we've got an organic way, an approved way of helping those farmers eradicate weeds. It's literally an open flame going down between the rows of the crop. It takes the cell wall and ruptures the cell wall, essentially, and kills weed in that way.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The April World Ag Supply and Demand Estimate Report from USDA calls for lower corn and higher wheat stocks in the U.S. at the end of the marketing year. The outlook for wheat calls for lower supplies, reduced domestic use, unchanged exports, and higher ending stocks. Wheat supplies are lowered to 110 million bushels because of lower than expected imports, while feed and residual use were lowered by 25 million bushels. Projected ending stocks were raised to 852 million bushels, but are still 17% lower than last year. The latest USDA agricultural trade update has good news for U.S. farmers and exporters. There's also news from an economist who puts that update together every month. Gary Crawford has more.
If USDA economist and trade tracker Bart Kenner sounds a little rushed today, there's a good reason. We'll get to that in a minute. First, we now have the official ag export numbers for the first 5 months of this fiscal year, October through February, and
exports were $77.1 billion, up 26%.
From the same time frame a year ago, and what's the continuing news on the export front?
Those big jumps in corn and soybeans.
Not only are shipments of corn and soybeans running about 77% ahead of a year ago,
we're getting a higher price for them as well.
Corn export values are running 108% higher, soybeans 118%. So that's all that Bart Kenner has time for right now. And Bart, why is that?
I've got to run to ultrasound appointment.
For his wife, because Bart's little daughter's about to have a little baby brother.
He's almost here. We're only looking at a couple more weeks.
So Bart will be off next month in a changing role.
Yes.
Yeah, so we'll talk then with economist Dylan Russell.
I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
American consumers feel agriculture can be part of the solution to climate change rather than the problem. A new Cargill Feed for Thought survey says those who indicated climate change is important to them also rate livestock and agriculture lowest in negative impact compared to other industries regarded as significant contributors. More than one-third of the respondents expressed confidence in the industry's ability to limit its contributions to climate change. That's your news brief for today. Coming up next, will there be a new environmental regulatory board in California? We'll be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide, nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. ProMax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRite Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/ProMax for more information.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
The State Assembly is considering a bill that would create a new environmental board. AB1, by Assemblymember Christina Garcia, would create the Board of Environmental Safety within the California Environmental Protection Agency. It also raises and recasts existing fees within the Hazardous Waste Control account to fill a projected deficit of approximately $18 million. The Assembly Committee on Environmental Safety and Toxic Materials heard the bill at their committee meeting Thursday. To learn more about the bill, here's audio from that meeting.
Okay, so usually we delay committee members until later. However, because of the important nature of AB 1 and the fact that it was already up prior, I would like to hear that one first. Yes, please. And for those presenting from the committee, if you can go up to the lectern, that way you can see all of us at once, and it's easy for the TV to see you as well. So, all right. Madam Assembly Member, please, when you're ready.
Thank you, Dr. Quirk and members. I'm here to present AB1. I like to think that it's the number one priority for the Assembly. I don't know that everyone agrees with me. but an important bill that we've been working on for years. The legislature has been raising a wide range of issues with the performance of DTSC, including extremely long permit process times, poor enforcement, delayed sites, remediation, and failure to respond to public concerns. We have made numerous legislative efforts over the years to improve different aspects of DTSC, but previous administrations have either vetoed such efforts or asked us to hold off while internal efforts to improve the department were underway. Unfortunately, none of these internal efforts have resulted in substantial improvements to its operations, which is why last year we introduced and passed AB 995. Unfortunately, the governor vetoed AB 995, asking the legislature to further fiscal resources for the department. We've introduced AB 1 with the same identical language to last year to indicate our commitment to the reforms we negotiated as a baseline for negotiations. AB 1 starts high-level actions to reset DTSC into a department that is more transparent and accountable. The bill makes four categories of programmatic changes that implement recommendations of the independent review panel to improve DTSC. Number one, it creates a Board of Environmental Safety, which is a policy setting and permit appeals body that will consist of five members. Number two, takes action to help refocus DTSC on its core mission critical responsibilities of protecting the public and the environment from toxic substances. Number three, it reestablishes the fee task force to set up a pathway to evaluate DTSC's fee structure and identify a funding structure that would provide sufficient resources for the department to carry out its mandates. Number four, makes statutory changes to improve and speed up permitting processes that also ensures proper financial assurances are in place. I do want to recognize that the governor has put forward a budget proposal this year that has picked up many of the elements of AB 1, but as identified in the analysis, there are still significant differences. The administration is currently engaging stakeholders in the legislature in negotiations to work through these differences. I am hopeful that we will get to a lot of common ground and to the same page in the near future. The administration has also provided the legislature with information on their fiscal shortfalls, information that we have been asking for nearly 2 years and are appreciative of this information. In conjunction with the stakeholder process, I'm hopeful that we finally can get significant movements towards improving DTSC and protecting public health. This bill will not solve all of the problems at the department, but it will help place DTSC on a more solid fiscal ground to ensure communities are safe. My community has been a poster child on toxics for a while. You've heard about Exide. It's not the only thing plaguing us. And so we want to make sure that we do not have any more Exides in the future. With that, I respectfully ask for an aye vote.
Thank you, Madam Assembly Member. I want to say that this is, even if this becomes attached to the budget, that this is this may be the one policy hearing that we have. So after we've heard the witnesses, I really do want to hear in detail, hopefully short detail, but in detail, because we only have 3 hours or 2.5 hours left. I may go to 12:30, so perhaps we have 3 hours, but we don't have a lot of time, but this is extremely important. It probably is the only policy hearing. And I'm very grateful that Assemblymember Garcia has worked on this bill, giving us a chance to comment on it. It's been a two-year effort. While the administration's proposal is similar to this, there are differences, but it is extremely important for us in this hearing to give the administration feedback. And in fact, they want that feedback. They want to hear from us. So your testimony today is going to be doubly important. And the other point that has been made by many of you is, well, DTSC has had problems. How can we be assured that DTSC will use additional monies properly? I'll just say to that without the additional funds, they'll never recover. Today, we will be joined by members of the administration that can speak to the policies being put forward by the bill, as well as the similar policies being put forward in the governor's budget. Phone moderator, we would like to hear from the witnesses in support. We have a witness in the building, or?
No. Apologies.
Okay, so phone monitor, we wish to hear from the witnesses in support. First, Don Koepke with the California Council for Environmental and Economic Balance, known as CEEB, C-E-E-B. Madam Koepke, please begin your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Dawn Koepke with McHugh Koepke & Associates on behalf of the California Council for Environmental and Economic Balance. CEEB is pleased to support AB1 by Assemblymember Christina Garcia. As you may be aware, CEEB has worked closely and in good faith over the past 2.5 years with Assemblywoman Garcia and the Assembly on meaningful reform for DTSC, most notably via her AB995 in 2020, which she was pleased to support following amendments to address some of the key concerns and priorities of our members. While much work remains, CEEB supports AB1 as a first step to meaningfully address issues raised by CEEB and other stakeholders about transparency, accountability, responsiveness, and timeliness of DTSC across its program areas. With regard to the establishment of a DTSC governing board, CEEB has long had concerns with the potential for politicization of hazardous waste generation, management, site remediation, and cleanup efforts in the state. Issues related to hazardous waste management and cleanup are complex issues that warrant a level of technical and professional expertise in the membership of any proposed board. Even now, these issues are the subject of much consternation and concern from communities and the business sector alike. It is imperative in establishing the Board of Environmental Safety under AB1 that members appointed to serve on the board have expertise to tackle these complex issues and appointments be made without political agenda. We believe AB1 has struck the right balance to this end. In addition to the structural, programmatic, and regulatory reforms AB1 seeks to make, which are important to CEEB and its members, it would also provide for short-term fee increases within the hazardous waste control account to support the department's activities and development of the hazardous waste management plan and fee task force. Notably, agreeing to these short-term fee increases does not come lightly for CEEB and its members, who are already straddled with increasing costs associated with DTSC oversight and permitting without corresponding full DTSC efficiency, responsiveness, and timeliness of permitting and other regulatory decision-making and reforms. Nonetheless, CEEB members acknowledge the importance of a funded DTSC to make progress on these issues, but are clear in their expectations for meaningful progress to address the concerns raised. All in all, AB1 is an important first, meaningful step towards progress for DTSC. It is not the end of the road for work on hazardous waste, cleanup, and funding issues in California, but a first step that will necessitate the administration, DTSC, the legislature, and stakeholders committing to work together over the coming years to continue to address the complex and fundamental governance, programmatic, regulatory, and fiscal challenges that will continue to need work. CEEB and its members commit to that work and will continue our efforts to be solutions-oriented as it relates to all things hazardous waste and site cleanup. Thank you.
We'll be right back with more from the hearing.
Thank you. Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
We continue our coverage of the State Assembly Committee on Environmental Safety and Toxic Materials hearing on AB 1, which would raise some hazardous waste fees and create a new Board of Environmental Safety for the state. We continue the hearing now.
Next, we'll hear from Carolyn Farrell on behalf of the Center for on Race, Poverty, and the Environment. Madam Farrell, you may proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Quirk, Vice Chair Smith, and members of the committee. I'm Caroline Farrell with the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment. I appreciate Assemblymember Garcia's efforts to advance a long overdue process to hold the Department of Toxic Substances Control accountable to meet its fundamental obligation to protect public health. DTSC has failed in its significant legal mandate to enforce health and safety and civil rights laws to protect the public and the environment from toxic harm. It has also broken the trust of impacted communities throughout the state, and significant changes are needed for the agency. For 8 years, CRPE has been working with members of the People's Senate, particularly groups like Committee for a Better Arvin, Committee for a Better Shafter, and the Delano Guardians for governance changes like a board to increase transparency and accountability. We know, though, that for the board to provide transparency and oversight to the agency, it needs to be thoughtfully composed, and additional reporting and accountability structures need to be put in place. We also know that any increase in fee authority needs to be preceded by ongoing oversight by the public and the legislature and reflect the polluter pays principle. We look forward to working with the legislature, the administration, and impacted communities to ensure DTSC is able to successfully address and prioritize the needs of those who have historically been harmed by hazardous waste mismanagement. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and also for being in time. Next, we're going to hear from Jared Blumenfeld, the Secretary of the California Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Blumenfeld, could you come up to the microphone? Thank you. Thank you for being here today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Quirk. Thank you, Assemblymember Garcia and other members of the committee. My name is Jared Blumenfeld. I'm the Secretary of the California Environmental Protection Agency, and DTSC is one of the board's departments and offices that I've spent the most amount of time from day one on this issue. Just to frame it from a critical perspective, if you think about communities around California and what they're concerned about, if you live next to an old hazardous waste facility that hasn't been cleaned up, think about the impact that has on your property values, on your psychology, on worry about your kids playing out there. There's between 150,000 and 200,000 sites that have not been cleaned up in California. So the magnitude of the problem really demands us address this issue. I really want to thank Assemblymember Garcia. We've worked in collaboration with her office and many of the people that you heard testifying today. This is an administration and legislative priority. I want to say that we take this incredibly seriously. From day one, you'll hear from Meredith Williams. Dr. Williams has been an incredibly effective and competent leader in making sure we don't wait for changes to come, that we make them and make the organization as efficient and effective as it possibly can be. But these changes, institutional reform changes, that many people would say, wow, couldn't we just do something completely different? I want to posit that this is the time to help this agency change? There's a lot right with DTSC, and there's a lot that we still need in terms of accountability and oversight that I think we're in agreement on. So I would say that the trailer bill, which is about 226 pages, as Assemblymember Garcia said, it incorporates a great deal of the negotiations that we've been working on together. I've been personally involved in hundreds of hours of meetings on DTSC reform. I want to thank all the staff and consultants that work for this committee and others that have been engaged in it. The trailer bill also has $300 million to start the process of investigating those sites I was describing, of starting to clean them up, of building economic recovery. When you look at the Biden, President Biden's Build Back Better plan, there's a whole section on how we help disadvantaged communities. And one of those is to get rid of the blight of toxic sites. DTSC also needs to make sure that in the future, California is leading so that we don't have hazardous materials and chemicals in the products that we buy. You shouldn't need a PhD like Meredith in order to buy shampoo or soap or things for your family. And unfortunately, we do, because the legislation isn't, and DTSC's authority could really be bolstered in this case. So for me, this is the year to get it done. Like, we cannot wait. I really, like, from my heart, my priority, like, I will do everything that I can to work with you and stakeholders to make sure we get this done, because it cannot languish another year. And unlike, you know, other issues where there's a specific facility like Exide, this is the whole kit and caboodle. This is everything. And we will be putting people's lives and communities at risk if we don't achieve reform this year. So I will work throughout any process that anyone engages in order to solve some of these issues. The only distinction between what Assemblywoman Garcia said and myself is I feel like the bridge has been really narrowed to a few key issues, and I can see the light at the end of the tunnel to DTSC reform. So I just want to thank all of you in advance for helping make this happen. I think when we look back on this victory, we can be really proud that we built a better agency, that we got good governance in place, and that we protected California's communities that have waited a very, very long time for this. Thank you.
Move the bill. All right, there's been a motion and a second. We'll now hear, and thank you very much, Mr. Secretary, for taking time out of your busy day. This shows your dedication to getting things right to DTSC. Next, we're going to hear from Dr. Meredith Williams, Director of DTSC. Please testify. And if you can, when you testify, if you could talk about the differences, or perhaps the Secretary will want to do that, between the administration proposal and what you have here, so we can give feedback on it.
Thank you, Chair Quirk. Thank you, Assembly members, and a special thanks to Assembly Member Garcia.
I think you need to get closer to the microphone.
Okay. Is that better?
That's much better.
Okay. So thank you, Chair Quirk, and Assembly members, and a special thanks to Assembly Member Garcia for keeping this issue in front of you, in front of the public, in front of all of the stakeholders, so that we can take this opportunity to really resolve the issues with the department, or take this major step toward resolving issues. As you all know, we started this process last year. COVID came along. We made great progress through AB 995 and learned a lot from that. And as a result, the proposal that the administration put forth in the trailer bill this year does address many of the things we learned from the stakeholders last year and many of the elements of 995. There are some differences that we are between last year and this year, and I will highlight a couple of them. Number one, we have now completed those workload analyses that really tell the world what we are doing with our resources. What is it that we are able to address in terms of our statutory mandates and requirements, and what we can't do because we lack the resources. And in keeping with that, the administration's proposal is comprehensive. It is the transparency, it is the accountability, but it's also the full fiscal stability for the department, both in terms of addressing very critical needs in the short term, things like making sure we maintain our federal delegation to implement and provide oversight for RCRA, Things like making sure we're enforcing in these vulnerable communities. We've put in enough. We're not just closing that general fund gap. We're also increasing enough of the resources to address some of these critical needs. It is not the full solution for the long term, but we would now have a board that would be able to have that fee authority to continue to look at the mandates that we have and make those decisions about what the priorities are and where the funding should be to meet those priorities. So it's a good start, and the $300 million is a terrific down payment. It would accelerate our ability to build the capacity for an investigation and site discovery program and have that in place so that if we get the long-term funding, we can then build on the $300 million and start to chip away at that huge number of sites around the state. So one of the big differences is that we are not calling for a fee task force because we've done the analysis on the fees. We've put forth a fee structure that's simplified, it's streamlined, it keeps in mind some of the economic impacts of the pandemic and the burdens, and we're mindful of that. It's based on a polluter pays principle. And it will serve us. It will serve us till such time as a board can decide what additional changes might need to be made down the road, and including just continue. You know, our fees have not been adjusted since 1998. And I think you all know that, but it bears repeating that, you know, we can't wait. We're already a year late because of the pandemic. And now to wait again for a fee task force to come up with an alternative proposal, we think would be quite challenging for us and for the department just because of the burdens on the general fund. So that's one of the most significant differences. And then I would only highlight that we are having ongoing engagement with you. I've had the opportunity to meet with some of you one-on-one. The LEDGE staff has made themselves available for weekly detailed discussions about what the issues are and where the key points of concern are. We're having similar meetings with community-based just organizations and environmental justice organizations and with the regulated community. And it's through that process that we will really understand what else needs to happen in order for us to have enough alignment to move this forward through the budget process. With that, I'll stop there and happy to be available to answer any questions. And I appreciate the opportunity that you've provided for the engagement, for the LEDGE staff engagement, and for future discussions to keep the process moving.
So, Dr. Meredith, if you could stay up for a minute.
Sure.
So what are the main differences right now between the administration proposal and the proposal that we have before us in AB1?
Well, number one, first and foremost, I would say, is the difference between the fee task force. We are not calling for a fee task force because we feel confident about the analysis we've done and the basis for raising the fees. And we looked at a number of possible models to structure the fees, and we're talking about both TSCA and
just speak more directly into the.
We are proposing changes to both TSCA and the HWCA funding, so it's more comprehensive in that sense.
Okay.
So that I think that the fee structure is the biggest difference. There are differences in terms of the constituencies and the boards and some of the details, but honestly, I don't see those as being I see us as having very productive conversations about those issues, and I'm optimistic about resolution.
All right. So for the members, if you have concerns about particularly the fee task force not being in, we'll want to hear from you about that. I will add that I think that the additional people that you're looking for are essential and that you can't get your job done without them. However, I know that many of the members here are concerned that the money be well spent and that given the problems that have occurred in the past, how can we be assured that that money will be well spent?
Well, I think the workload analysis really tells a story about how we are spending the money and what resources we are what we're doing with the resources, and we can now build on that to provide ongoing transparency about our use of resources. So, number one, that effort is not a one and done. It will be an ongoing conversation. Number two, I think there are some differences between last year and this year. Number one, there was some concern that we weren't increasing the level of service of the department, and now we're proposing to do that. But number two, we heard that there wasn't enough accountability in the proposal that we put forth last year. And a lot of those accountability measures were taken into account in 995, and we have adopted a lot of those, and we're trying to see if there are opportunities to go even further in putting deadlines in place, reporting out to the board whether or not we're meeting our commitments for permit decisions, sharing what our strategy is, what we're working on. And then I will say that internally, even without a board, I am working hard to find the opportunities to provide transparency. I will say that the pandemic has highlighted opportunities and pitfalls of remote meetings, for instance. So it provides a lot of transparency. It took us a while to make sure that we could have those meetings in a way that community members could be heard. But we are able to do that. We are able to hear concerns and address them. We've reestablished our public meetings independent, again, of a board, and those are opportunities for us to get feedback from our stakeholders.
Okay, and I will note that SEEB, which represents many of those business interests that will be taxed or have increased in fees, is in support of this bill.
The committee voted 7-2 to move the bill forward. It now goes on to the Committee on Appropriations. That's our show for today. If you know of a person or a topic you'd like us to feature, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This has been the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.